my God, there is no force and no strength except in your power, and no deliverance for me from the detested things of this world save through your preservation. So I ask you by your far-reaching wisdom and your penetrating will not to let me expose myself to other than your munificence, and not to turn me into a target for trials. Be for me a helper against enemies, a coverer of shameful things and faults, a protector against afflictions, a preserver against acts of disobedience. By your clemency and mercy, O most merciful of the merciful.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were saying, which was regarding how Friday congregational prayers, this Salatul Jum'ah, is one of these important factors when it comes to our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah. We talked about how it is Allah, the Exalted, the Mighty, who has asked us to recite these Friday congregational prayers. And of course, there are many spiritual and even material blessings when it comes to not just congregational prayers, but specifically Friday congregational prayers. We had recited the verse of the Holy Quran from chapter 62, verse number 9, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah the Exalted, the Mighty, says to the believers that when the call for the prayer on Friday is made, hurry up towards this prayer and leave all business. Now, one of the things here, dear brothers and sisters, which is good to talk about, is that, well, the Friday congregational prayers, they demonstrate the power of the Muslims. And of course, this is a meeting place for the faithful worshipers. So there is something very beautiful, something very powerful, something very meaningful, something very spiritual when it comes to a group of believers, a group of Muslims coming together and praying together, worshiping Allah together. It is almost as if this prayer and the power of this prayer, this namaz, this Salatul Jum'ah, becomes exponentially so powerful because everybody has collected, that not only as a collective is our ubudiyah and our servitude of Allah enhanced, but as an individual, our ubudiyah and our servitude of Allah is enhanced as well. And of course, when it comes to the worship of Allah, when it comes to ubudiyah, when it comes to being the abd, the servant of Allah, we do all those things which Allah has commanded us, which Allah has requested us to do. Now, one of the things which Allah has requested us to do is to make sure that we as Muslims, those who are subservient to Allah, we show our social and our political and our economic power. Allah is the source of all power, and He wants us to show our power, especially show our power against any and all forces of evil. And so yet another way in which Friday congregational prayers enhance our ubudiyah. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Surah Al-Araf talks about this conversation between Allah and Shaitan. It's a conversation that I have mentioned before in my lectures. It's one that I think should be constantly revisited, where Shaitan lays out his plan against a human being with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that Allah, I'm going to now ambush them, misguide them, right? مِنْ بَيْنِ أَيْدِيهِمْ وَمِنْ خَلْفِهِمْ وَعَنْ أَيْمَانِهِمْ وَعَنْ شِمَائِلِهِمْ. Okay? That I'm going to misguide them from the front, from the back, from the right, and from the left. Now, what those sides mean, I've discussed those before in a different center. I don't want to go down that route again. But I do think it's important that sometimes what causes our anxiety and stress is what مِنْ بَيْنِ أَيْدِيهِمْ. What is in front of me? What is meant by what is in front of me is how I see my own self and my own actions moving forward. Okay, and now hear me out here. I don't want to go past my 30 minutes. I only have 15 minutes left as it is. So a quick reminder for myself and for all of you. This idea that we don't accept the amount of amal and deeds that we do. We should never become spiritually complacent where we're comfortable with the amount that we do, convincing ourselves that what I do is far more than enough to get myself into heaven. Those are satanic and very destructive thoughts. However, the other side is also very dangerous, where I feel no matter what I do, my God won't accept me. I am bound for the hellfire. There's no way that God's going to make me successful in the hereafter. Right? And this level, while we're trying to be humble, we trickle into hopelessness. Let's be very careful, please. Let's not fall into the trap of the humbleness of our amal becomes the hopelessness of our amal. Because when that hopelessness lingers around for a while, anxiety comes about, stress comes about, this defeatist attitude comes about. No matter what I do, it'll never count, so what's the point of me doing it? And lo and behold, that one moment of humbleness becomes kufr and disbelief very, very quickly. We end up saying there's no point in me doing it if it won't be accepted by God. And the point I want to make about that is that is shaitan. That's where shaitan comes in. That's one of the ways that he misguides us, is that he actually allows us to feel and think that God wants things beyond what I can give him. He's never satisfied, ever satisfied. And that causes us a lot of anxiety. Right? That's why sometimes, you know, it's not my topic, but sometimes this idea of contemplation, tafakkur, tadabbur, think, introspection, self-thought, right? Even Western psychology now says, spend some time with yourself, close yourself out. This seclusion, this quarantine that right now we're in is a gift from God sometimes. I'm not saying the deaths are, but it is sometimes a blessing for us, an opportunity for us to quiet ourselves down, find ourselves alone, and really truly think. The problem is that we are fearful of our own thoughts, scared of our own thoughts. Part of it is because we just either feel that we are always going to be insufficient or that God will never accept anything that I do. Okay? And that's a fine line, guys. Fine line.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. سبحانه ما أعظم والملك لا شريك له لبيك إن الحمد لك والعز لا Africa Today.
Protests and demonstrations have continued to rock Chad following a military takeover after veteran ruler Idriss Déby Itno died fighting rebels. Many have taken to the streets of the capital in N'Djamena rejecting the installation of Mahamat Idriss Déby, the son of the late president, as the head of the transitional authority. Now, the masses want the military to step down in favor of a civilian leadership.
We're in a country where human dignity is flouted and we have had enough. We have suffered a lot and now it's enough. We want the military power to leave and to let us choose our leaders freely. We are not puppets. We are tired.
Hello and a warm welcome to Africa Today, which will focus on the unfolding crisis in Chad, where the governing military council is cracking down on angry protesters who are defying a ban to demonstrate against the junta that took over power in violation of Chad's constitution. Now, in the second segment of our show, we shall talk about the renewed push to return the famous Benin bronzes looted by Britain during its colonial rule in Nigeria. But why are Nigerians demanding the return of these sculptures? A Nigerian curator here explains.
Edo people, it's important for Nigerians, it's important for Africans, because it's a huge testimony of our history, of our culture, and of the exquisite craftsmanship that produced these masterpieces.
Join us for more till the end of our show and send us your views and opinion as you watch.
Trouble in Chad. The newly re-elected president of Chad, Idriss Déby, died of wounds he suffered on the front line while commanding his army in battles against rebels in the north last April. The shock news of Debbie's death came only the day after the 68-year-old career military man was proclaimed the winner of a presidential election that had given him a sixth term in office. In the aftermath of the death of Idriss Déby, who ruled with an iron fist for three decades, his 37-year-old son, Mohamed Déby, was installed as chairman of the Transitional Military Council of Chad. The military takeover has triggered protests, with Chadians insisting that the country is not a monarchy and that the constitution should be followed. Several people have been killed by security forces during protests. A resident of N'Djamena explains here why they came out to protest.
They talk about democracy in theory, but on the ground there's no democracy. That's why people came out today, to protest and demand their rights, because we're fed up.
Now, in a bid to prevent the situation from escalating out of control, the chairman of the Military Council of Chad, Mohamed Déby, has called for dialogue.
Ces valeurs si chères à notre défunt président.
These values, so dear to our late president, will be demonstrated and enshrined in the framework of an inclusive national dialogue that will be organized during this transition period. I will be the guarantor of this dialogue, which will not shy away from any subject of national interest, according to a precise timetable that the government will be called upon to reveal.
Now, former colonial power France has come under sharp criticism for backing the illegal military takeover in Chad for its own vested interests in this North Central African nation. Now, for an incisive analysis on the situation in Chad, we are joined by Abayomi Azikiwe, the editor of the Pan-African Newswire. He has traveled extensively in Africa conducting field research on political economy and history. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Azikiwe. Now, what is the current situation in Chad after the killing of Déby and the appointment of his son as the interim president?
It's very tense because there is opposition to the establishment of a transitional military council. The president of the National Assembly was slated to take power in the country in the event of the assassination or the incapacitation of the president. That did not happen. And still not clear exactly under what circumstances President Idriss Déby Itno was killed. The government said he sustained injuries while on the front line against the FACT rebels, yet no specific information has been released to the international press.
Thanks for that, Mr. Abayomi Azikiwe of the Pan-African Newswire.
37-year-old Mohamed Idriss Déby, a four-star general, is in charge of the Transitional Military Council, which was formed after his father's death. He is therefore acting as the de facto interim president of Chad for a period of 18 months. According to Chad's constitution, which was suspended by the military, the Speaker of the Parliament must take over when a sitting president dies before elections can be held. Leading opposition parties in Chad have rejected the military takeover.
Chad is not a monarchy. There can be no dynastic devolution of power in our country.
Now, under Chadian law, the Speaker of Parliament should have taken power after Deby's death and not his son. Now, why did the army refuse to obey the constitution?
There's concern about the overall stability inside the country. Chad has been a bulwark of France and the United States in their efforts, so-called counterterrorism campaigns in Central and West Africa. There was some trepidation in regard to moving forward with the same political dispensation. The son of the president, 37-year-old Mahatma Dibe Itno, was appointed as the chairperson of a transitional military council. Now, it appears to people on the outside of the country and many inside the country that this was a coup d'etat because they did not follow the constitutional protocols that were voted on by the Chadian people. So it's a very serious issue, and also internationally, the African Union wants some movement in regard to the current regime that is operating now in Chad.
Idris Deby, who came to power in a rebellion in 1990, was an important Western ally in Africa for three decades. He facilitated military intervention by France and the U.S. in Africa. Following the death of this veteran ruler, White House offered sincere condolences while France said it had lost a brave friend. Now, to underscore the importance of Chad to France, Emmanuel Macron was among the foreign dignitaries who attended Idris Deby's funeral in N'Djamena. Now, Mr. Azikiwe, as you mentioned earlier, Idris Deby was a darling of Western powers, especially the United States and France. What are the interests of these imperialist powers in Chad?
Chad is an oil-producing state. It is also located on the border of a number of important countries, such as the Lake Chad Basin region, where Nigeria is located, and Cameroon, which are huge oil-producing states. Also, former President Dibe was willing to utilize his military forces as a conduit for AFRICOM, United States Africa Command, and also Operation Barkhane, which is a French military operation in West and Central Africa. And both these militaries are there to represent the interests of Washington, Wall Street, and Paris. They claim they're in the region to strengthen the security capabilities of various African nations so they can fight against Islamic terrorism. But as many people already know, a lot of the groups that are said to be terrorists previously have been supported by the U.S.
Idris Deby died of his injuries following clashes with rebels belonging to a group calling itself FACT, or the Front for Change and Concord in Chad, in the northern part of the Central African country. Founded in 2016 by former army officers, the group, like opposition politicians and rights groups in Chad, accused Deby of repression in the run-up to the election. These rebels built up their base in Libya in the Tibesti Mountains, which straddle northern Chad and part of southern Libya. How powerful is the rebel group that killed President Deby?
They were previously based in neighboring Libya. They were allied with Khalifa Haftar, who is the head of the Libyan National Army. And of course, Haftar had been for many years, decades even, an asset of the United States Central Intelligence Agency. Since 2011, he was flown back to Libya during the counter-revolution against the previous Jemahiriya government under Colonel Gaddafi. When Gaddafi was overthrown and killed, Haftar made several bids to take control in Tripoli, all of which were unsuccessful. Now there's a new United Nations-appointed government of national unity in Tripoli, And it's interesting that this factor, rebel group, left the country in the immediate aftermath of the establishment of this UN-appointed government.
Idris Deby established ties with the Israeli regime, which provided him with weapons to sustain his brutal grip on power. Chad is among several African countries utilizing deadly weapons acquired from the Israeli regime that are used for repression and other human rights violations.
Now, the Israeli regime fueled the conflict in Chad by supplying Idris Deby with weapons and thus enabled him to extend his dictatorship. Now, can you elaborate further on the role of the Israeli regime in destabilizing Chad?
Since 2016, there have been contacts between the State of Israel and the Debe administration. Foreign Ministry had visited Chad in 2016. In 2018, the late President Debe visited Israel. Israel has supplied intelligence assistance as well as weaponry to the Chadian military, which serves as a linchpin in terms of providing ground troops for all these military operations that are going on in Central and West Africa over the last several years. So Israel is very much involved because they want to, of course, be involved in Africa as well because of its strategic resources and also in an attempt to undermine the Palestinian struggle and the struggle in Syria.
Now, the aftershocks of the death of Idris Deby Itno on April 20 are only beginning to appear. The future of Chad remains fragile and uncertain. Instability in Chad is bound to have far-reaching repercussions across the Sahel region. Now, a resident here expresses fear of clashes between the military and rebels.
War destroys the country. Now there are soldiers who confiscated power, and those guys over there are saying they are going to come. We don't agree. If they come, there must be a dialogue.
Now, Mr. Azikiwe, several people have been killed protesting against the military junta. Now, should we expect a turbulent and violent transition period?
So it depends on the political and social balance of forces. It appears as if there's unease in the country among the working people, the youth, and farmers inside the country, and perhaps even elements within the military as well, that this new government was installed without any consultation or any participation on the existing political parties as well as the National Assembly.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Azikiwe, for your insight. Now we shall take a short break. And when we come back, we shall talk about how Western countries are reluctant to return Benin bronzes looted during the British colonial period. Now, don't go away.
Benin bronzes in the West.
In 1897, British colonial forces razed Benin City, massacring an unknown number of people and bringing a violent end to the Kingdom of Benin, which had thrived for centuries as one of West Africa's major powers. Now, during the raid, British troops looted at least 3,000 precious items made by the Edo people.
The looted items included ivory statues, craved elephant tusks, ceramics, masks, craved portraits of kings, and more than 1,000 intricately decorated brass plaques that once adorned ancestral altars and court buildings in the city's royal palace. Benin City, situated in modern-day southern Nigeria, was famed for its specialist bronze sculpting guilds. groups of skilled artisans that produced works of huge historic and cultural importance. The looted bronze statues have spread further and further afield over the years, popping up periodically across Europe and the United States. Now there are increasing calls for the return of these precious cultural heritage items.
We want outright return of those things here. They belong here. This is where they were made, and we know the purpose, the reason why we made them.
Now to discuss the return of these looted cultural heritage items belonging to the people of Benin in Nigeria, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot, Mr. Mbaluto, and it's great having you. Now, first, can you tell us how important are the Benin bronzes to the people of Nigeria and Africa, actually, in general?
Very, very important, because most of the artifacts or even sculptures represent the cultural mix, the cultural heritage of a country. And therefore, when we talk about all these bronzes, they represent the culture of Benin City, you know, everybody from that particular country where they were taken from. They also represent, like, the history, the heritage of the Kingdom of Benin. We are speaking right now, the British Museum has got about 900 pieces of that. Benin court has requested them to be taken back, but the negotiations are still ongoing. That's where we are with that.
Julius Mbaluto, the African Affairs Analyst.
Western art historians and museum professionals claim that various forms of danger in the West have historically posed just as much as of a threat to the Benin bronzes as a perceived lack of climatic control found at Nigerian museums.
Now, this is while Africans have been making their artifacts and preserving them for centuries before they were looted by European invaders. Now, some museum professionals claim Nigeria and Africa in general does not have the technical capacity to take care of its cultural heritage. What's your take?
African professionals are capable of doing anything that the Western countries can do, given the chance. And therefore, to say Nigerian professionals are not experts enough to keep is just an insult to adding an insult to injury. What they need to do is just take these artifacts back. They need to just take everything they took from these countries back, because this is part of this country's heritage.
Now, amid mounting calls for restitution, institutions like the British Museum, holder of the world's largest collection of Benin bronzes, have been forced to consider returning the stolen heritage items.
A new museum is being built in Benin City to facilitate this. But as it stands, most of the looted bronzes will only be returned on a temporary, not permanent basis. A resident of Benin City, like most of his compatriots, rejects the preposterous idea of loaning the bronzes instead of permanently returning them.
The question I may ask, is it their own property? Why should you loan my own property to me? You cannot loan my own property to me. You understand? They stole it quite well.
Why are most Western museums insisting on a temporary return of these looted heritage items instead of permanently returning them to where they rightly belong in Africa?
The countries that have housed all this, for example, like talk about if you came to London and say, oh, let all this go back to the countries that you came from, most of these museums will be left empty. You know, these museums in London, they make so much money from tourists who go to see all these things. And, you know, the key thing is that it's all about the money involved. And therefore, you find that definitely the wealth they are making, they don't want that to let that go. That's why it's so difficult to get it done.
The people of Nigeria are eager to reconnect with their looted heritage, but it remains to be seen if museums in Western countries will stop their greed and return these looted items of African heritage.
The governor of Edo State, whose capital is Benin City, says talks are ongoing about returns that are expected to be a boost for a broader movement building across Africa and beyond, seeking colonial era loot.
We would, you know, be open to such conversations. So there's just not one track. decision as to whether it's going to be a loan or a permanent return. You know, we will be open to having a broad range of discussions on each piece of work.
Mr. Baluto, last question to you. Now, will the return of these Benin bronzes have a domino effect that will see the eventual return of other African heritage artifacts looted by colonialists?
One of the fears that countries that looted all this wealth from Africa fear, if they say yes to one country, there will be a domino effect. Other countries whose wealth was looted, they'll follow suit. And that has always been the greatest fear. How do I know? Probably. I covered the Mau veterans case in courts in London, which they won. One of the greatest fear was another country would pursue the same line. And it's not just one country, it's many. So the fear of the domino effect is always there, definitely. And yes, if we cannot say just this Benin bronze. It's been done successfully in Kenya. There's one of the tribes, Kalenjin. Some artifacts were returned to them. So now that it didn't follow suit, it doesn't mean it cannot follow suit. It depends on how it is done. And depending on how it is done and so how successful it becomes, yes, there could be a domino effect. Probably that's why the people who are holding all these artifacts fear.
Well, one thing that should be made clear is that the return of these looted artifacts is not a favor by Western museums to African countries, but it is correcting historical injustices committed against the people of Africa. That's it for this edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to our program For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Today we are going to discuss an important issue, and that is obedience to Allah or worshipping Allah, because worshipping Allah is tantamount to obedience to Allah. And both worshipping and obedience go hand in hand together with each other. So, first of all, I would like to say that when a tourist, I'm just giving an example to make our audience or to enable our audience to understand the example of obedience better. Well, when a tourist intends to visit an area, the first thing that comes to his mind is to get the map of that area. He will take the map, study it very carefully, look into it, and identify the places that he intends to visit to save himself some time. That's the purpose, of course. And he reads the map so that when he is in that area, he would not waste his time asking and inquiring about these places. We Muslims, we as human beings, are actually tourists in this life. We are not intended to stay here for a long time. And of course, this life is transient. This life is temporary. We are going to stay here for some time and then, of course, leave for the eternal abode. And that is the permanent place, the permanent place of residence, of course. And therefore, just like a tourist, like any tourist, we need that map here to identify our way in this life, to know which way to go and which way not to go. Of course, Allah is the architect and the designer of man. He sent a road map which some people are willing to look into it, others disregard it and throw it away. For example, the Quran, which is a permanent miracle, tells us very clearly to follow the right path. The instructions are given, and those instructions provide us with clues and with clear picture of which way is the right way and which way is the wrong way. And so we have to look at the map. We have to study that map very carefully. So first of all, we have to understand that Allah has sent us a map. And when you open it, you find two major highways in this map, of course. Each of these two major highways has two main entrances, which we have to locate and study carefully. One of them leads us to paradise, and the other one leads us to hellfire. Of course, the Quran says, فَأَمَّا مَنْ طَغَى وَآثَرَ الْحَيَاةَ الدُّنْيَا فَإِنَّ الْجَحِيمَ هِيَ الْمَأْوَى. Of course, we are not here to interpret these verses of chapter Nazi'at, chapter 79, and the verses verse 37 to verse 40. We are not intending to interpret these verses, but these verses are, of course, very clear in their purport. The translation of the verse is like this: then those who had transgressed all bounds and had preferred the life of this world, the abode will be hellfire. And as for him who fears to stand in the presence of his Lord and forbids the soul from low desires, then surely the garden, that is the abode. Of course, فَإِنَّ الْجَنَّةَ هِيَ الْمَأْوَى. So these verses, of course, clarify very expressly, very explicitly, that there are two ways to follow. And of course, one way leads to paradise, to Jannah, and the other one leads to Jahim. Jahim is the hellfire. And of course, as we can see, there are two groups of people, one rebelling against God, فَأَمَّا مَنْ طَغَى, one rebelling against God, some, okay, and the other fear to stand before their Lord. they fear their Lord. They are those who, because of fear of Allah, do not commit any sins. God says, Jannah is going to be their eternal abode. And it is now up to you, brothers and sisters, to choose which way to go and which way to follow. God has given us the capacity to distinguish the right from wrong, the truth from falsehood. God has clarified everything for us. He has clarified the road for us, which leads to either hell or heaven. Both roads are clear, and there is nothing in this map ambiguous or murky or dark. Everything has been clarified meticulously by Allah. When you open the map, Allah says, these two entrances lead to either the hellfire or to paradise. A person who rebels against God and who transgresses the bounds, the limits prescribed by Allah, then, of course, his eternal abode is the hellfire. And, of course, God, the Almighty, has distinguished the angels with reason. It means that the angels have reason only, have intellect, aql. They do not have lust, and they do not have wrath, anger. The animals have lust, and they have anger. These two faculties are there. But God honored human being by giving human being both the faculty of reason and shahwa and ghadab, both of them. Inshallah, we will carry on, and we will further discuss this issue in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is on me. All I need, it's all I need. All I need. Is all I need.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The Associated Press has fired a news associate, Emily Wilder, for violating the company's social media policies, a move that drew backlash from journalists after it became clear that Wilder had been targeted by right-wing media outlets for her pro-Palestinian activism in college. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Manvi Singh. The piece is titled Outcry After Associated Press Journalist Fired Amid Row Over Pro-Palestinian Views. Stay with us for more of Manvi Singh's article. The Associated Press has fired a news associate, Emily Wilder, for violating the company's social media policies, a move that drew backlash from journalists after it became clear that Emily Wilder had been targeted by right-wing media outlets for her pro-Palestinian activism in college. Emily Wilder confirmed to The Guardian that she was terminated for violating the company's social media policies in their news values and principles sometime between my start date on 3rd of May, and yesterday. Wilder said the Associated Press did not detail which of her tweets broke its policies. A spokesperson for the Associated Press said that while the organization generally refrains from commenting on personnel matters, we can confirm Emily Wilder's comments on Thursday, 20th of May, that she was dismissed for violation of Associated Press's social media policy during her time at Associated Press. The spokesperson added that Associated Press's policy exists so that one person cannot create dangerous conditions for our journalists covering the story. Every Associated Press journalist is responsible for safeguarding our ability to report on this conflict or any other with fairness and credibility and cannot take sides in public forums. There's no question I was just cancelled, Emily Wilder told SF Gate on Thursday, 20th of May. She said her editor had previously told her she would not get in any trouble because everyone had opinions in college, but then came the rest of the week. Right-wing and conservative media outlets began publishing stories this week about Emily Wilder, who had previously worked with the newspaper Arizona Republic after graduating from Stanford University, when the Stanford College Republicans tweeted a thread highlighting her previous activism. The tweets included screen grabs of Wilder's previous Facebook posts in which she is critical of Zionists, including Sheldon Adelson, the late billionaire and Donald Trump's supporter. The thread took off. The right-wing Washington Free Beacon speculated that Wilder's hire in Phoenix could fuel concerns about the Associated Press's objectivity amid revelations that the news outlet shared an office building with Hamas intelligence in Gaza. The article was amplified by Tom Cotton, the far-right senator from Arkansas. Although the Israeli regime's military claimed that Hamas intelligence were operating in the building housing the Associated Press and Al Jazeera offices in the Gaza Strip, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he had seen no evidence indicating that that was the case. Fox News Channel referred to Emily Wilder's hiring as a second Middle East-related issue for the Associated Press after the organization's offices were bombed in the Gaza Strip. Emily Wilder, who is Jewish, had tweeted 18 times since she began working at the Associated Press. Most were retweets. Her most subjective post was about objectivity on 16th of May. Objectivity feels fickle when the basic terms we use to report news implicitly stake a claim, she wrote. Using Israel, but never Palestine, or war, but not siege and occupation. These are political choices, yet media make those exact choices all the time without being flagged as biased. The News Media Guild, the union that represents the Associated Press's editorial and technology staff members, said it was investigating Emily Wilder's firing by the Associated Press. The Guild asked if the comments that caused Emily Wilder's termination were posted before or after her hiring, and is awaiting a response from the Associated Press. Meanwhile, journalists responded to news of Wilder's firing with outrage and messages of solidarity. "I stand with Emily," wrote Rebecca Sanders, an Arizona Republic reporter. "Her reporting at our newspaper was excellent. Reverse your decision now. I'd bet a lot of money this person is about to get a much better job," tweeted NBC's Ben Collins. Several reporters drew contrast between Emily Wilder's treatment and that of CNN's Chris Cuomo, amid allegations that he advised his brother, the New York governor Andrew Cuomo, on how to respond to sexual harassment allegations, but did not face major disciplinary action by CNN. Others pointed out that the Stanford College Republicans, who targeted Emily Wilder, had a proclivity for inviting speakers known for their sexist and racist views. For example, in 2019, the group invited the conservative author Andrew Klavan to speak at an event titled "Yes, America is a Judeo-Christian Nation."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss the problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. And to help us with these questions for our dear ones, the future of our community, we have with us Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. Sayyid Abdullah, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. It's always nice to have you with us.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's always a pleasure being here with you.
All right, so Sayyid, let's talk about natural disasters today. I'm going to start with a story I have myself. I remember once I was visiting my cousin, and that night there was an earthquake. And no one sensed that earthquake except his five-year-old child. And we had a very serious problem trying to calm this child down all the way till the morning that he was not going to be buried under a pile of rubble, especially that he had heard from the news that there are chances that there will be more earthquakes coming. It happens that we're living in this era of the COVID pandemic as well, and I'm guessing that a lot of children out there are worried that they'll catch the virus or that their dear ones will catch the virus and they'll lose, for instance, their parents. So a lot of parents might be struggling. How can we give comfort to our children, Sayyid Abdullah?
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So like you mentioned in your story, with earthquakes, hurricanes, tornadoes, natural disasters, even these days viruses and biological warfare, or whatever it is that they might be going through. The thing is, the kids these days are exposed to a lot of material or materials in this regard, either online or either on the media, or either naturally, like depends on where you are, where you live, the geographic place you're situated in. It could be subjected to earthquakes, for example, or it could be subjected to, hurricanes or floods, or just viruses, basically. So it depends. So it depends on the level of exposure on the child. That will definitely leave an impact when it comes to the anxiety, when it comes to the depression, and when it comes to the mental state and mental health. So that really affects them. So it depends on how much they're exposed, the more that fear will increase. So, for example, that story that you said about the child that you had experience with, if he's exposed to too much earthquake material and videos, for example, and he's seen what happens to people when earthquake happens. So all these images, all this information comes to mind, and he thinks it's going to happen to him. So naturally, his natural response would be fear, and he would be crying out of fear and out of anxiety, and he would want some sort of safety. Right?
And there's no use talking sense to them. Like, talking science is not going to work. Because I tried that and it didn't work.
No, see, the thing is, like, even scientifically, that the children, because their brains haven't developed, their brains mature at the age of, like, somewhere in the 20s, their full brain matures. So trying to debate with them or trying to do comfort them or talk to them in a scientific way at their level, it definitely not going to work. It might make sense to them. They're like, oh, okay, makes sense, but they will not understand. That's why, for example, we have syllabus and the textbooks in our schools. They start slowly trying to build their information as they get to, you know, a higher age. So in this case, instead of trying to explain to him scientifically what an earthquake is, try to give him a bit of comfort. Just give him a hug and say, you know what, let's go for a walk where there's no building, there's nothing. So he feels more safe.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to take a break now, but we'll be back after the break to further our discussion. Don't go away.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing with Sayyid Abdullah. And we're talking about how to give comfort to our children in the face of natural disasters, whether it's earthquakes or viruses. Before the break, you said that, so you can't talk science to them because it might make sense to them, but their imagination is too powerful to convince them. We have to give them some other kind of comfort. One day my friend said that I saw a child who was worried about riding a plane. And he said to his mother that because it goes too fast.